Yeah, thank you very much. My brother has already rendered our apologies to you for having to let you stay this long. So my work is actually on the implementation of social protection in Ghana. I'm looking at how it builds citizenship and state capacity differently. But given the limited time I have, I would focus rather on citizenship. And my interest is actually based on the fact that since the publication of the World Development Report of 1990 on poverty, social protection has gained a lot of traction. But analysis of social protection programs have largely focused on their economic effects and what some have considered to be the proximate effects of social protection. But beyond those proximate effects, there are also some transformative effects that actually tackle the very basis of the poverty and vulnerability that the beneficiaries of social protection suffer. And so that actually is what one of the reasons that actually motivated my study. So that's my outline. I'm not going to spend time telling you about them. So recent discussions on social protection have largely focused on what some researchers have referred to as technocratic fixes, focusing largely on policy design and then issues of impact evaluation. But such discussions look at social protection as if they are apolitical. Okay. Yeah, meanwhile, social protection involves a lot of political decisions. I mean, they involve targeting, they involve resource allocation, they involve issues of conditionality. And so there's that invitation to go beyond those technocratic analysis of social protection to look more into the political issues that actually influence the implementation of social protection programs. And so one of the recent works by Sam Hickey and then his colleagues at the University of Manchester, they make the point that politics needs to be at the center of efforts to understand social protection programs in low-income countries. But even here, one gets the sense that this attention to, the call to attention for politics in social protection largely also focuses on the incentives that drive elites to take decisions in relation to the adoption of social protection and then also implementation. And it has not helped us to see to what extent that kind of politics of adoption and implementation also translates into certain kinds of effects that will ultimately affect the very structural issues that underlie issues of poverty and inequality. And so I am seeking to contribute to the discussion on the politics of social protection by drawing on some influential works of Paul Pearson, looking at some works of Douglas North, Stokoe, and others, to see how even though politics actually leads to the adoption of social protection, they also generate certain kinds of effects that ultimately affect the political processes. And as I said, I seek to look at this from the lenses of citizenship, which has been defined by scholars like Marshall way back in 1950 as a status bestowed on one who is a member of a society. And it seeks to look at citizenship from three dimensions, the political dimension, the civil dimension, and then the social dimension. But more importantly, I'm interested in the aspect of the social dimension because it seeks to look at how people within a particular society live some lives of dignity, meeting what society actually considers to be the best way or the best, the proper way of living in the society. And so by that, I'm looking at the aspects where social protection, for instance, fosters some element of inclusion in the processes leading to racial distribution, for instance, in society, and then also whether it can also trigger or shape their sense of agency in the political processes. And why Ghana? I'm using Ghana as a case for looking at the implementation of social protection because it's one of the countries that have been the one of the shining examples of democracy in Africa, having attained its independence in 1957 as the first country in the sub-region to gain independence from colonial rule. But despite some progress in the last couple of years, poverty and inequality are still rife in that country. And in trying to address some of these issues, the government of Ghana, through collaboration with some transnational actors, have introduced several social protection programs, including the Livelihood Empowerment Against Poverty, the National Health Insurance Scheme, the School Feeding Program, and recently the Free Senior High School program. But there is also evidence that the nature of politics within Ghana actually shapes how these social protection programs are implemented. And so the two programs that I seek to look at are the Livelihood Empowerment Against Poverty and then the National Health Insurance Scheme. The LEAP is a conditional cash transfers program targeted at the poor and vulnerable in Ghana. It actually looks at the bottom 20% of what has been described as the poorest of the poor in Ghana. And the beneficiaries are largely aged people of 65 years who don't have anybody to depend on, also pregnant women, orphans and vulnerable children, people with severe disabilities. Now, the way beneficiaries benefit from the program comes about through a four means targeting mechanism. The first one is a geographic targeting that selects poor districts. But recently, all districts in the country are now benefiting from the program. Now, when the geographic targeting is done, then there is also a community targeting within the districts to find out those that actually deserve to benefit from the program. And then after some officials now use questionnaires to do a proxy means test to select those who are eligible. And on the basis of that, finally pick those that are going to benefit from the program. But then there has to be a community validation of that list first before they can now benefit from the program. Now the program is implemented from the national level, so there is the LEAP Management Secretariat housed under the Ministry of Gender, Social Protection and Children. And then at the district level, we have the District LEAP Implementation Committee headed by the district chief executive, who is the political head of the district. And then at the community level, we have the Community LEAP Implementation Committees, and then in some cases, the focal persons. Then with the National Health Insurance Scheme, it is a quasi-contributory scheme that was introduced in 2003 by the NPP government in response to various agitations against the cash and carry system. People would normally go to the hospital and have to pay out of pocket. And the NPP government at the time felt that was not the best way to go. And so it brought in the National Health Insurance Scheme to address this challenge. The scheme is compulsory. It has three different types. There is the district mutual health insurance scheme, and then there is the private health insurance schemes, and then there is private commercial health insurance schemes. So my attention will be on the district mutual health insurance scheme because it covers about 96% of those who are actually registered on the health insurance scheme. And the scheme is actually funded through these means. 2.5% on value added tax on goods and services, and then 2.5% from SNIC contributions, then from the informal sector, and then allocation from the parliament and others. And but within that scheme, there are also beneficiaries that are targeted. What this means is that they do not pay for their subscription, but there is an annual registration and renewal. So this is a theoretical framework that guides my work. Essentially, borrowing from the welfare state literature, the argument is that program recipiency has two kinds of benefits. First, there is resource effect, where as a result of the receipt of program benefits, beneficiaries develop capabilities, both in terms of meeting their basic needs and also having access to state officials in ways that then allows them to trace their welfare to the states. And as a result, it develops their capability to want to engage in the political processes within, the political and social processes within their communities. But then also how the state actually engages them in the implementation of the program also sends some signals, messages to them as to how the state actually views them, whether they are a burden to the society, and then again, how their fellow citizens also see them, whether they are building to the society, whether they are deserving of respect, and all that. But are these effects always guaranteed? And are they always positive? There is an argument within the welfare literature that suggests that programs that are targeted or that are means tested are likely to cause, I mean, feelings of stigmatization, disempowerment, and other effects that normally wouldn't be positive and are therefore likely to stifle the agency and sense of inclusion of beneficiaries. But the reverse is the case for universal programs or contributory programs where both the poor and the vulnerable actually benefits from the program. And so there is that potential for some kind of cross-class mobilization between the rich and the poor in society. So on the basis of that, these are my research questions. Do universal or contributory social protection programs shape citizenship differently? And if so, under what mechanisms and through, under what conditions and through what mechanisms do this happen? In selecting my sites, I try to look at different contexts to see whether the differences can bring up some differences in outcomes in ways that can help us understand implementation better. And so I selected two districts in Ghana, the Kwau Afram Plains districts, which has very limited state presence or state capacity, and it's also largely rural, as opposed to the adjacent Jabi Municipal Assembly, where there is a very visible state presence, and then they have a very pronounced legacy of state formation. And as a result, they have that propensity to mobilize around program implementation. Now, one challenge with works of this nature that seek to adopt qualitative approach is to what extent are you able to trace impacts to program recipiency? I seek to do that, avoid the attribution bias using a process tracing, giving me a very diagnostic view of program implementation, and then also triangulating my sources of data in ways that will allow me to compare the responses that I get to the secondary sources to see whether my sense of attribution is strong enough. And then I also introduce in my questions a temporal dimension that seeks to look at the before and after implementation. So here are my findings. In terms of the ability of the program to actually build a confidence of citizenship, in their communities. I got a sense that the livelihood empowerment against poverty was able to help the people benefiting from the program to now redefine how the state actually saw them as actually members of the society, and also whether or not they are considered to be burdens to society. Now, if you look at one of the quotes that I have here, one beneficiary says, for instance, that now everybody knows that it is not as if they enjoy sitting down doing nothing, and that when they are given some kind of support, they can also try to add some kind of value to their lives. And so they feel quite recognized within the society, and they also feel that now there is an opportunity to also contribute to the development of their society. But in terms of some sense of agency, the finding that I got was that the beneficiaries were not able to, for instance, make claims of program officials. So, for instance, somewhere in 2010, although they were supposed to receive about six different transfers, they ended up receiving about three, and yet there were no complaints. I'll explain why that was so. But in the case of the NHIS, I realized that at the initial stage of implementation, beneficiaries were able to make claims, for instance, because they feel that they had actually contributed to the program. And then again, because they were also, the rich and the poor were able to mass together, they were able to demand better source of implementation. But in later years, especially around 2009, coming to 2016, you would realize that this was actually not the case. Yeah, my time is running, so I'm just trying to jump some of these. I'm trying to explain why these outcomes are actually generated from the two programs. I noticed, for instance, that in the case of the LEAP, especially in relation to the parts where they were unable to make claims of program officials, it was partly or largely because the program was not framed as of right, but it was more, a gift or a favor to beneficiaries. And on the basis of that, beneficiaries felt that if they were to complain, they were being ungrateful, or even in some cases, their names could be deleted from beneficiary lists. Whereas in the case of the NHIS, yes, at the very initial stage of implementation, people felt a sense of self-worth because they no more dependent on others to seek health. And then again, when they went to the hospital, they were given the drugs that they needed to cater for whatever disease or ailments that they had. But in later years of implementation, this was not the case. And it is largely because of the processes actually leading to the adoption of the National Health Insurance Scheme. Somewhere in 2003, the government actually rushed through the processes of adoption because the 2004 election was actually approaching. And because the government, the then MPP in opposition had promised the citizens that it was going to introduce the health insurance scheme, it had to actually implement it to have something to say during the 2004 elections. And so a lot of quality assurance issues were actually not taken care of. Some of the issues, for instance, being the fact that, political considerations also influence the kind of benefit package of the scheme. So the NHIS, for instance, takes care of over 95% of disease burdens in the country. For a scheme that has a broadly targeted component, such benefit package was quite ambitious. In later years, the program was no more sustainable. Yes, the program was no more sustainable to the extent that now service providers, when they submitted claims for payments, did not get their payments in time. And that also affected how they were able to stock and also now provide the necessary medicines for beneficiaries. And so most beneficiaries go to the hospital and they are made to do top-ups. And in some cases, they have to pay for even their cars to be verified. If you take the case of the Kohua Franklins, for instance. And so these are some of the issues that actually explained why beneficiaries now do not feel that sense of agency to now demand better forms of implementation. And maybe one last point. So I noticed, for instance, that even though in the welfare literature, the argument is that in cases where there are no better forms of implementation, both the rich and the poor can mass up against program implementers. I found a reverse case in Ghana. Here, the rich or the middle class rather resorted to other forms of health care, leaving the poor to rather struggle or grapple with the poor form of implementation with the NHIS. I think I'll end here and then maybe invite your comments because I think the time is limited.
Your evidence from your literature review was that we would expect universal social protection to have different types of political effects on citizens to retirement reforms. You're suggesting that's not really coming through, that other things will shape the social effects of social protection. Can you go into that?
Yes, so the point I was trying to make is that, so in the case of the National Health Insurance Scheme, for instance, at the initial, the few first years of implementation, that was actually the case. So beneficiaries were able to mobilize around program implementation. And so there is evidence in one of the districts, the Ejusujabi Municipal Assembly, for instance, where beneficiaries were able to demonstrate against the National Health Insurance scheme because they felt, for instance, that their health insurance cards were not released in time. They had to queue for longer periods and then only to be told, for instance, that machines had broken down and so they had to go and come back. And so as a result of that kind of mobilization, even in some cases, registering some of these protests at the office of the member of parliament of that place, that actually enabled some kind of reform in ways that the scheme was actually implemented in that district. But then in later years, as a result of the fact that the National Health Insurance Authority or the scheme itself was not able to reimburse service providers who are not only government officials but also sometimes private hospitals, pharmacies and others, it therefore meant that they could not provide the kinds of medicines that beneficiaries of the scheme are entitled to. And so over a longer period, you realize that the size of the benefits was actually shrinking. And the welfare literature suggests that whenever the generosity of program recipients is rather small, that motivation for some kind of cross-class mobilization around the program recipients is actually very limited. Yes, Edward.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation. I guess I'm happy for you to elaborate a bit about the citizenship bill, being a joint program. You get a sense that building of citizenship is actively pursued as an outcome of the program design, or is it a given that by the program itself,
okay, so I noticed that the program itself is not framed around citizenship. In fact, it says that, or the objective is actually to look at maybe access to nutrition and smoothing of consumption in the short term, and then building human capital in the longer term. But there is no specific framing of program messages, for instance, to suggest that it is a form of rights and has that ultimate objective of actually building the citizenship of beneficiaries. And that actually translated into the beneficiaries then seeing the program as some form of gifts from government. Even in some cases, some of them even thought the program was actually led by some NGOs. And so they were stopped from actually complaining about the way the program was actually implemented, for instance. Yeah, so even so, for the NHIS, I would argue that the initial language actually surrounding the introduction of the NHIS was that the citizens actually deserved better. And so the cash and carry system that had been a major, even disincentive for seeking, health care, had to be abolished. And so it was actually on that basis that the NHIS was introduced. But the processes actually leading to the adoption itself was largely influenced by the political realities within the Ghanaian context.
Thank you. I wondered if, given the NHIS was funded primarily through broad-based taxation, whether you noticed a change in citizenship level at one of the more fundamental duties of the state, the levying and spending of taxation. Did you notice, perhaps, or inquire about a rise in tax avoidance, in protests or grumblings, perhaps, if it didn't boil over into protests, particularly among those upon tax burden for its harvest? Did you notice a change in citizenship in that regard? Because we talk about this in qualitative terms, but often, certainly my experience living in Kampala, they were rather unhappy about the way taxes being spent. That's one of the more immediate ways in which the government can feel that feedback. When people start to avoid the tax, they start to feel that their money is being misappropriated. And of course, you might argue that a critical element of your feeling about citizenship is your willingness to part of your money in the form of taxation and the way it's been spent. I wonder if this has come up in your research.
Yeah, so I think that was actually more to do with the processes leading to the adoption of the NHIS. So it met a lot of opposition from the TUC, the Trades Union Congress, for instance, and then also largely a lot of people within the former sector. And that was partly because some of them were opposed to the idea of using their social security benefits to fund the scheme. So one way the government actually tried to address this concern was to make the membership of the program free, in quotation marks, to those in the formal sector. So what they do actually is that they pay only registration fee or renew their registration every year, but they don't actually pay a premium to benefit from the program. And then again, in relation to issues of tax avoidance, that element of tax is actually inbuilt in the price of goods and services within the country. And so once you buy, you indirectly, whether you are in formal sector or informal sector, actually contribute to that component of the funding.
Thank you. We are nearing towards the end of the program. We are at the end of the program. I will now undertake the Herculean task of trying to summarize and trying to link the various papers today so that we can try to have a bit of a reflection session, which I promise will be very short because we're all tired on today. And so the first session was, you all probably remember, I'm just doing the work on coffee right now, it was on framings. We had Tamara and her colleagues talk about a potential framework they presented to us on how we could potentially include refugees and migrants within national social protection schemes. And then Sam raised some very pertinent questions. The one that hit me really the most is on whether social protection automatically leads to sort of progressivism. Is it progressive automatically? And if I understood correctly, his answer appeared to be no, which to me is really interesting and something to think about. After that, we moved into papers which were more case studies. And with the first set of papers before in the second session, they were about politics and development of welfare and associated issues in the global north. And something that's really interesting to me that struck me from what Toby said with his paper on Berlin was he said, perhaps we should try to conceptualize it as not really about a case of citizens versus vulnerables, which is, you know, the question we're trying to answer today, but about the haves and the have-nots, the people who have and the people who don't have, which then, you know, even within citizens, there are haves and have-nots. And so to me, that was an interesting way to conceptualize the issue. After that, Pietro talked about resettlement and how even migrants and refugees have aspirations towards social welfare, and in the absence of that, they actually withdraw their application and try to move elsewhere where they have social welfare. Something that to us should be almost obvious, but isn't necessarily represented in policy. Then we had lunch, after which there were the final two sessions, and the third session, to me, the papers were, I mean, the way they talked about those, a couple of the papers were about discourse and how that sets ideas and agenda, and then the Jab's second paper on what really is impacting ideas about migrants and about refugees, and his answer appeared to be also in the realm of ideology. He said, well, it's really ethnocentrism that is driving the hatred and not an issue of economics. And he said, well, what would the policy implications of that be? It probably might mean that changing, you know, throwing more money at it may not be the solution. And then to me, that ties in with the issue of the discourses, because if you cannot solve it by throwing money at it, maybe then you need to start talking about it differently, which is where the Bangladeshi and the Turkish examples were interesting, partially, you know, what works and what doesn't. And in the fourth session, we saw a discussion on very many nitty-gritty issues of social protection in the Global South. We already had some Global South papers in the earlier sessions, but in the fourth session, I think Elena with a paper on low-skilled migrants was, to me, it was interesting because when we got the very many abstracts that were submitted in the call for papers, low-skilled migrants weren't really, people didn't seem to be working on them much. People were working on refugees, and that's it. That's the only type of migrants there are. And so I'm particularly grateful to her for covering this topic. And then the final two papers on the question of citizenship and on the relationship between social protection and citizenship gives us an insight into, well, if you were to extend social protection to certain groups, what does that look like? Does that necessarily lead to very many changes? If you can't see changes within, you know, within native population itself, we could potentially ask, what are we going to see within non-native populations? So that's where we are, and I would welcome comments from you. These don't have to be questions, and for once we will not snatch the mic away from you if you take it a little longer than you anticipated, on any thoughts you have that you'd like to share with us. Anything that struck you? Yeah? Please.
I'd just like to come back to a couple of the things that you raised in your question. One was about the question of citizens versus vulnerables and how it seemed to be set up a little bit like the vulnerables for the migrants, but recognising that there's different levels of vulnerability within the country as well, and that maybe it's about sort of prioritisation of redistribution. There's a lot of the debates about targeting eligibility has come up within the context of particular programs, and then maybe considering migrants just adds another level of complication maybe to that, but it's sort of about whether migrants are considered within the same programs or whether it's, you know, different programs or priorities for them. So that was kind of coming back to the big question and framing of it, whether it's as clear cut as that, and what it helps us to think about the whole robotization. The other thing is you mentioned about sort of different types of migrants, and how we talked a lot about refugees, but there was some discussion as well about those skilled migrants and how these groups might have different status, both through perceptions of the groups, but also how they participate in society. And that this has implications for, again, coming back to redistribution, thinking about social protection really as redistribution within society of resources. And the level of contribution to that, who's contributing, who's benefiting. So this sort of brings, coming back to questions, some of the framing questions at the beginning, about social justice, rights, eligibility. Again, it's kind of how just thinking about migration in terms of when we think about welfare states or about social protection structure. Again, are we saying that programs that are for migrants specifically, are they social protection, or is it more thinking about the bigger system and whether migrant groups are integrated into that or not, or whether if different programs are provided, does that count as social protection, is that something else? So basically, there's lots of questions raised, but it's really interesting how different cases came back to some of these framing questions.
Thank you. She's done a better job at it than I have. So, that was really helpful.
I was really interested in what Benda in Benda's presentation.
Benda's presentation, that is the link between social protection and domestic violence. I'm very interested if there are more empirical evidence of that from other countries. Because as I know, there are some studies in India said if women have more assets, that decrease the lack of a victim of violence. But if that kind of cash transfer is reducing domestic violence, I'd like to know if anyone else in the group has more evidence from other countries.
Okay. There are a few studies that I've read from Central America that show in many cases in which cash transfers are given to women that we see sometimes an increase in violence, but if nothing else, greater reliance on women as producers anyway. And so we see male heads of household doing less work and contributing less to the household due to the money that has been given directly to their wives or to their partners. So it's almost kind of opposite.
So you also can increase the violence.
I don't remember exactly the specifics of it, but I think a lot of it had to do with sort of a culture of machismo, right, in which women have now become providers and there's some jealousy or aggression toward that change in role and the way in which men view themselves because they're no longer providing in the same way.
Or is it in nature of alcoholism and gambling because the men want to have possession of that money for their own either for their alcohol consumption, gambling, sex workers. I mean, there are many other, like women will be earning and men will be snatching the money for husbands will be making the money for their own.
Yeah, I'm not sure as to whether or not it is tied to certain addictive behaviors.
I think you might find some of this in the literature on
microfinance.
So it's mostly meant towards women, and then it was appropriated by the men, not necessarily for alcohol and gambling, which essentially was appropriated by the men. Leaving the women, nevertheless, in
in charge of reimbursing that back, I mean, returning that to the microfinance institutes, and how, so therefore the harassment they face from MFIs, they face it even though they were wrong, not really in charge of reimbursing the money in the first place.
One response on this, there are studies from India that have shown that when there are cash transfers done to women, there is a large indication of the money being actually spent on the family. However, this does strengthen the narrative that women need to be the primary caregivers in the family. So it's sort of a win-win situation where A, you are expecting the women to spend the money more on the family, and secondly, further burdening the women with the responsibility of the family. But that aside, the comment I did want to make was about I wish conferences like these actually had more migrants and refugees speaking themselves. Yes. I understand that you can't control it completely because it depends on the papers that you actually receive. But I think if, as a research community, if we could make better efforts to actually bring the voices that we've quoted so many times actually to the podium, it would be much more useful.
Definitely. I'm not organizing another conference in a year. But if I were to next time, I'll keep it in mind.
For my colleagues, in the sense that when we did present the framework, I think we do not argue that this should be a framework for migrants or refugees solely, and I think we all agree on that. It should incorporate all. The challenge, however, is when you think about social exclusion and you think about the different dimensions, the social, the economic, the cultural, often these already coincide with rights, and the fact that often these migrants, whether they are refugee, whether they are economic migrants, they are already excluded. So there are multiple fault lines that build on each other. But you're absolutely right in arguing, yes, when it comes to citizens versus vulnerable, do not forget that some of the vulnerable are actually citizens, and they should be incorporated as well. And that is also what we say when we start to speak, or for example, about moving towards a national social protection program. This is not just for covering non-citizens, but also for citizens. But I wanted to raise one other point, which was brought up several times, and which I also think is relevant to tie into consideration when we talk about social protection and vulnerable, and that who is it that we need to look towards to? We often talk about in terms of a social contract where we look at the relation between a citizen and the state and see the state as the duty bearer, see the state as the provider, but they're not the sole provider. So I think what we came up with today is, first of all, you have some discretion on a local community sometimes when it comes to implementation, but also you have other forms of providers. This could be NGOs. I know from the Middle East, for example, faith-based organizations are also an influential provider. And I think we may need to start talking about different forms of social contracts that actually reinforce each other when it comes to social welfare provision.
Thanks. So before I give the mic to what I find problematic, though, about what we're appear to be arguing is that, well, no, citizens also have vulnerables, and so it's a matter of prioritization. We should remember that citizens have vulnerable people in them. But at the same time, within social protection literature, we're increasingly arguing for universalism, right? We're saying, oh, we shouldn't make that distinction, because the moment we do, there are adverse effects on the typology of programs, on the design of programs, on the effects of programs, which tend to become worse if we target beneficiaries.
And also stigmatization.
And stigmatization, and so on and so forth. So how is this going to be? What are we going to actually say? Are we saying everybody who enters the country, we should consider everybody as recipients? And how is that really going to pass on a political basis? I'm not certain, but it's something to think about. So
that was exactly my question.
No, but thank you for this conference. Is it, well, having been at Manchester and the social protection literature is very strong, and all thinking about social protection has a quiet revolution, right? So today was like a wake-up call, and it's like, it's not as great as we thought it would be.
which is, I think, we're starting to think critically about it, so that's great. Now, my question, and I don't need to be the devil's advocate, but I really have been thinking about this since the very first presentations, is like, first of all, why should the state care about the vulnerable, particularly if they are refugees, right? Some of the state discourse is always like, we're good enough that we're actually even accepting those refugees to be. So now you're asking them even more, oh, by the way, you need to provide them with social protection. Oh, and by the way, treat them as well like the other citizens. Like, at least they have an incentive to provide for the citizens because of voting rights and all sorts of reasons. But then what is this incentive that will render the state willing to even support refugees on a longer-term basis? So that's the other point. And the last one is, I think, Mohammed... Nope, here we go. You had it in your bracket, but the state capacity. Like, even if the state generally wants to help the refugees, what about state capacity? And here we're not just talking about Bangladesh or... But even Italy, right? You're having your own economic crisis. And we talk about Brexit a lot, and we talk about austerity. And talking about to states, even in the global north, about including refugees or... more in providing them with welfare when there is already a critique against providing this welfare to the citizens is quite problematic, I think, in terms of state capacity, particularly finance. So I have a lot to say about that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. We've shot down the very thing we used to champion. This was not the target when we conceived this conference. Any other thoughts? I'll do the awkward pause so that we're really sure that we have no other thoughts. Yeah, that seems final. Thank you so much, everybody, for attending and for staying so late. I hope we'll meet.